You're listening to the London Buddha Centre, talks and seminars from our home in Bethnal Green, exploring Buddhism in a way that is relevant to contemporary life.
Good evening. Yes, Subhadra Mahati talked to us last night about the wheel and the spiral, and how the spiral gets ever bigger and higher. Do you remember this image? And a tendency of the wheel is to get ever smaller and tighter, as though a knot is being tied. Okay, so the reactive mind actually gets tighter and tighter and smaller, like a knot being tied. And what I'm going to do is say a bit more about the nature of the knot, how it gets tied, and, a hint of which bit to pull on to start to untie it. And then I think that Vidyadhara tomorrow night will actually pull on the thread. We'll have to see. I don't know. Anyway, so the nature of the knot and something about how to untie it. In a way, my subject is don't look yet, the outer rim of the wheel of life. Okay. So we've heard about the cock and the pig and the snake in the middle, the six realms, the animals and titans and so on around that. The next bit as you go outward is my bit this evening. So I'm going to say something about karma and rebirth, which is in a way what that rim is about. Something about these 12 links, which that rim is made up of. Some things about habit and unawareness. And then something about freedom. Okay, good. So, yes, the outer rim of the wheel of life is an illustration of how we, traditionally this is, remain stuck in an endless round of rebirths. Okay, so not sort of immediately clear to modern audiences what that might mean, but I think there are two ways of understanding it. I think it might have been a didactic tool for people who weren't literate. So it was trying to show you in a way that didn't put the fear of God into people but might put the fear of rebirth into them, what they were stuck in if they were in the reactive mind. So that's why it's got sort of jazzy illustrations, which I'll go into in a bit, which are sort of quite animated and I think designed to make you want to get out of it. Okay. But anyway, I thought I'd just say something about rebirth and the context of that. So, I mean, we talk about conditionality because these links or our mental states condition each other, and they mental states arise on the basis of previous mental states. I'll say more about that later. But what this rim is really getting at least traditionally, like I say, is not being able to get out of dying and being reborn and dying and being reborn and having to go through the whole thing again and again and again, which traditionally for Buddhists is something you don't want. You don't want to keep being reborn. You want to get off the wheel onto the spiral. So that's the kind of traditional context of it. Anyway, so I thought I'd say something about how we might respond to that. Sangharakshita says that, 100 or 150 years ago, when Buddhism was becoming more popular in the West, you heard a lot about karma and rebirth and very little about meditation, and that it has now reversed. Okay, so the reason for that, he says, is that when science was advancing and Darwin published his theories, there was a certain sort of moral panic about the possible lack of an afterlife. So if God no longer rewarded you with either heaven or hell according to your actions, it means something very different about this life. And people were now grasping for ways for ethics still to matter. So if the main thing that governed behaviour, at least in traditional Christian societies, was that eventually you'll be rewarded, when that gets taken away, people were worried that so would the good behaviour in this life, if you see what I mean. So they were looking for a system that transcended what we know is quite often uncomfortable, i.e. life, and meant that it was still worthwhile acting well. And because Buddhism didn't have a creator God, but it did have something that happened to you after you died, and something that that meant about your behaviour in this life started to appeal. Meanwhile, the mysterious sort of introspection, now known as meditation, was more of an unknown quantity, more likely to, lead to sort of unknown, slightly suspicious routes that wasn't heard about so much. Anyway, now he says, people can contemplate the idea of nothingness after life with at least a degree of equanimity, i.e. it's ordinary and even fashionable to think at my death, my consciousness and my experience are just cut off, and that's that. So what? Tell me something I don't know. And actually, I mean, not only might meditation get more popular because we're more interested in realization here and now, but realization and progress here and now become vital if you want to have a better life, if this life is all you've got. Okay, so karma and rebirth are, you hear about them a lot less than you did, and meditation a lot more. But partly I wanted to point that out because so that we start to develop something of an awareness that our view of the world is actually just strongly conditioned by the time that we're born in, where we're born, who we know, what we're taught in school, and the kind of moral imperatives behind those worldviews, one or two of which I've just described, that make them actually quite important to have, and other ones quite threatening, and so on. Do you see what I mean? So thinking about rebirth is quite unfashionable, or, I don't know, people... It's quite often the bit of Buddhism people don't want to hear about, I notice, actually. And, you know, you don't have to believe in it, certainly in any literal sense, to be a Buddhist. But it's good to reflect that how we see the world is actually largely a product of our time. We don't know, really. But I'll come back to that. Whether or not we believe in any... I mean, I don't think rebirth ever would be literal, by the way, but whether or not we believe in any continuity of consciousness that would... any continuity of consciousness that would survive our physical body, we should be concerned with the effects of our actions, and this is karma, just the same, if only because we don't know their true reach. So we really don't know the effects of our actions. I mean, I think the famous thing is the butterfly beating its wings, which I've never found exactly sort of moved me to act in any different way. I don't know what the second half of it is. A butterfly beats its wings and somewhere a river changes its course or a country changes hands or something. I don't know what. It's supposed to be very significant. The butterfly beats its wings. Here's another way of thinking about the rebirth thing that I hope will put it in a context that can at least give us some sort of flexibility of mind as we look at this rim of the wheel. Gaura Vravati just mentioned that she and I first came on this winter retreat 7 years ago. And I was thinking, imagine if I was thinking of booking on that retreat. I can remember when I was thinking of booking on it, but not yet sure. And I went to the Buddhist Centre, and somebody I'd heard was leading that retreat was a bit unpleasant to me or something. They spoke in a way I didn't sort of quite like. And at that time, remember, I was only thinking of booking the retreat. And then it's not as though that might completely turn you off, but it might be the feather in the balance. So the next day I'd be at my computer thinking, oh, I was thinking of booking that retreat. But I was thinking of doing various other things as well. And, you know, half consciously, I might have a memory of that interaction that wasn't very nice. And there's also that party on New Year's Eve. And then something else happens while I'm at the computer. Later, the other impulse kicks in. You know, who knows whether I would have ended up at least committing my life to something more generous, i.e. the ordination and helping out with retreats like this, that kind of thing. Who really knows? So anything you even think doesn't really matter, you don't know, actually. And then I suppose consider the fact, I mean, you can do this in the negative as well, because I don't want to pretend I'm having all sorts of effects, but say I do continue to live a Dharma life and I manage to deepen it more and more and I do become very generous and very wise and so on, and I help other people to do the same. After I'm dead, that will still be having effects. And the people that will have affected will have their effects and so on. So there isn't really a literal, there isn't really a line drawn around my life after which it ends, along with the physical body, because my life isn't just my physical body, it just can't be. The ramifications of my life go, who knows how far, you know, and that's only me. We don't know the effects of our actions. That's all I'm trying to say. You probably get the picture by now. the order member who led the ordination course I was on said, you often hear people say that karma means actions have consequences. You can condense the teaching of karma. It's a famous word, isn't it? We all think it's kind of a cool word, and we like to use it and say, "Woo, that's my karma." The reality of what it means, it's not like it's less palatable, but it is a bit less cool, because it's about the effects our actions might have. And yes, the Dharmadeepa, this man who led the ordination course I was on, said, we like to think actions have consequences, except this little thing I'm about to do right now. And he's... look out for that. First piece of homework. I might even like to go around saying actions have consequences, and then just don't cover that over when I'm, doing whatever it is I do. But Dharmadeepa said, really, what the place you want to get to is, you know that when you're walking along a cliff edge, you instinctively pull back. So say you're walking on one of those bits of a path that's unstable, starts to give way under your foot. You whip your foot back and try to get it onto solid ground again. He said, you want to start regarding the ethical weight of your actions in just the same way. So you are scared isn't quite the right word. You take extremely seriously possible negative effects of actions, and value greatly possible positive effects. So I hope that wraps. Perhaps I'll just say one more thing about rebirth. Actually, I won't try and repeat the gist of it now. But I'm reading a book called Return to Life about children who experience memories of past lives, and one or two researchers who go about, if they can get the timing right, what they call verifying some of the detailed memories that these children have. It's quite amazing. Anyway, there's a chapter towards the end about quantum physics, and that's the bit that I'm not going to try to repeat. But it's very interesting to see that even previously materialistic branches of science are now saying themselves that consciousness is primary and actually creates what we think of as the material world. He even lists the theories that there's two camps in quantum physics, apparently. Last point on quantum physics. One that is in agreement that consciousness is primary and having all sorts of effects and totally relevant to this question of what atoms are doing and what it is for something to have charge and the implications of that for what matter might be and hence what life might be. And another camp that's resisting that, and he lists the theories. Obviously, he's on the consciousness side. He lists the theories and some of the proliferating, almost ridiculous theories that people are coming up with to keep consciousness out of science. It's really amazing. Like I said, I won't try and repeat it. You can read it. Return to Life, it's called. Good, so that's something about karma and rebirth and conditioned views. The main thing to grasp, I think, is that we're always bringing something into being. Just in the same way as I think the mind is always either reactive or creative, I don't think there's a neutral gear. We're always creating a certain sort of mind. We're always bringing a certain sort of mind into being. Okay, actually, this is the last point. This is a PS about rebirth. Whether or not you think there'd be some continuity of consciousness after your death, you're always remaking yourself. Okay, so on this retreat, you may have experienced a different sort of you. Maybe it's a bit brighter, a bit happier. I was thinking earlier about the sort of the little innocent things that you can enjoy on retreat and the sort of funny way in which that's not always available in day-to-day life, or the way you just want to laugh or want to have a positive little interaction and be sort of light and joyful. We're either creating a mind that's more like that or we're creating a mind that's less like that and going the other way. Think about the metta bhavana. So we are trying to consciously cultivate more positive states, and we think, you know, it's called the cultivation of love and kindness, and we think we're cultivating certain states while we meditate, and then we just go and eat lunch. But we're cultivating mental states all the time. I think that's really important to grasp. It's not just that we're in mental states all the time, we're creating them all the time, because they each arise in dependence on the previous ones. So, well, if you spend a metta bhavana session intensely fantasizing about lunch, I think Vididaka pointed this out, you're setting up much more disappointment for yourself at lunch itself, if you see what I mean. And then maybe sort of slightly different thoughts about your life altogether afterwards. I mean, if you feel a bit, sometimes as I do, sad as you put your knife and fork back together, I don't know if you look out for this at the end of a meal, I sometimes feel a bit like, oh, you know, it's just a tiny bit disappointing when the meal's over. You might have another disappointed thought after that, or you might start to extend that further, or think, oh, I don't know what to do with myself now. I always often feel a bit low early in the afternoon, and I wonder why I do that, and I wonder what it's up exactly in my life that's bringing that about, and so on. Okay, so you can see creation of mental states or cultivation happening all the time. So the point about karma and conditionality really is, what do we want to be becoming? Because we are becoming. We are becoming things all the time. So what do we want to be becoming? And what sort of world do we want to be bringing about? Because it's not a private matter, mental states. They have all sorts of effects on others. Okay. So the main point about the wheel is, what keeps us stuck in the reactive mind and keeps us in that tendency rather than in the more creative one? So we've heard not just broad, but sort of panoramic, quite wonderful overview of that. Like I said, I'm now going to go into, this is not a sort of bad news only, because I'm going to end with the freedom bit, but more detail about how we stay stuck in the reactive mind. So, if you take up your sheets for a moment, or if you can see one, I'll just whip us through very quickly the 12 links. Okay. And don't worry too much about exactly what these are, whether they're mental states or a sort of state of affairs or a series of different lives. So this will take less than a minute. Okay, in the upper right, just below the demon's right-hand tooth. Yeah. On his left, but whatever. Edit that out of the video. You have a blind man. Okay, that's spiritual ignorance. And as Subhadramati said, it's not that it's our fault that that's a fact of our lives. It's to do with investing things that really are changing, don't have an ultimate substance, and are unsatisfactory, with a sort of desperate dream or hope that they can actually deliver a substance, ultimate satisfaction, and something that lasts. Okay, spiritual ignorance, the blind man. The next one, the potter. Volitional actions. So that is actions based on the mental state of the spiritual ignorance. Okay. Traditionally, those are the previous life, but interpret that as you will. Okay, the monkey is consciousness. Okay, so that's the arising of consciousness in the new life, or if you like, a moment of consciousness in this life. Okay, the boat is mind and body. Mind and body. The house is the six sense bases, and that's the five physical senses plus the mind. The mind, it's not like that film. The mind being a sixth sense in Buddhism is just like the eye perceiving an object, the mind, an idea drops into it, or a memory, whatever. So if you think about it, it's actually the same as seeing something or hearing something. Okay. So the six sense bases, and that means consciousness based on them. So you're experiencing a sort of consciousness when you see an object, etc. Okay. And up to and including the house with the windows are what you could call the givens of this existence. Okay, so you can't really, well, as Vididaka was saying earlier, you can't really, I was enjoying the session, well, which we had in here at least, you might have missed a few in the library because I was thinking, it's brilliant, brilliant, this is making my talk so much easier, I'm loving it. These are the givens of existence. Here we are, in a body, with senses through which we have consciousness of the sense objects. Yeah, We see things, hear things, smell things, etc. Okay, now come the five links I'm going to focus on. So the next one, with the man and the woman enjoying their embrace, is contact. Okay, they're making contact, if you like. The man with the arrow in his eye, sort of ancient Tibetan equivalent of King Harold, is feeling. And that could be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. I think in his case, on balance, he's not liking it. You know, now I think about it, I'm feeling something kind of unpleasant. It's, you know, kind of bothering me a bit. Okay, so that's feeling, or feeling tone, like we've been investigating in meditation. The next one, the woman offering a man a drink, is craving. Okay, so there's feeling tone, either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. I'll say more about this, but we respond on the basis of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. The woman offers the man a drink, and that's like, well, if you don't like what's happening now, like Harold of Tibet here, she says, "Ah, but would you like?" Craving. And it's somebody offering somebody a drink, because the original word translated as craving is actually thirst, which is more physically immediate, isn't it? Craving, to know, always makes you think of people saying how good it is to give up smoking or something, but it's as immediate and physical and something you could even be desperate for, like thirst. You know what it's like, it's just a sensation, you just want to satisfy it. Very strong, such that sometimes you might not notice, or there might not be any space between feeling it and reaching out to satisfy it with something. The person picking fruit is grasping. The pregnant woman is becoming. The next one, as you can see, is birth. Here we move into the future life. So on the basis of craving, grasping and becoming, a future life, or another us, if you like, is created through the birth. And that self also dies. Okay, so the corpse being brought to the cremation ground. So that's the story of our lives in 12 links there. There's five I want to focus on. So I'll do that now. And that will allow me to say something about the reactive mind and habit. Okay. Okay. So, contact, feeling, craving, grasping, becoming. Those are the only, in a way, those are the only five you need. So you could draw a line around them later. So the first thing that's happening is something impinges on one of the senses. Let's say I have, again, actually thinking back to that first retreat, I remember a meal I want to have when I get home. Okay, I can still remember almost every day of that retreat, and including banal details such as I fantasized about a certain meal for quite a lot of the retreat, and I kind of re-sculpted it many times in my mind, and look forward to it immensely. And once the image, in this example, say, has come into your mind, you've made contact with something, okay? Just like seeing something or smelling something. It gives me a pleasant feeling, because I like that food, the lentils with the halloumi and the nice stuff that I did eventually cook myself. And as you can guess, it was quite nice and otherwise rather disappointing because of all the energy I'd put into it. Looking forward to it mentally. It gives me a pleasant feeling to think about it. I start actually wanting it, craving. Continuing to fantasize about it is grasping. Okay, so the pleasant, what happens basically is, I should have said this before, at feeling, that's really key, because after feeling, there's more of a choice. So feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, well, if it's pleasant, you want to perpetuate it. I think we've already heard this on this retreat, but it's so key. Pleasant feeling we want to perpetuate, unpleasant feeling we want to get away from, neutral feeling we're indifferent to, but it's sort of just as significant in other ways. So the pleasant feeling I get when I think about the food, I want to perpetuate it, so I kind of clench myself in such a way that it's almost like I'm having the meal. You know what it's like. If you actually give yourself to a fantasy, you can forget where you are. So I'm grasping after it, and what I'm becoming is Well, I'm investing more in something that's not going to satisfy me, as it didn't in the end. Like I said, it's perfectly nice, and there's nothing wrong with looking forward to a nice meal or whatever. But I definitely had a feeling of, like, is that it? Is that seriously the meal that I re-sculpted in my mind so many times? We're also becoming less aware of anything else that we might be aware of, okay? So we're investing something impermanent, unsatisfactory, and insubstantial with the opposite qualities, wrongly. But also think about what you might call the opportunity cost. Vidyadharka was on my ordination retreat as well, and I think I'll always remember him pointing out that what we think of as sort of innocent or mild negative states, like distraction or fantasizing about some object of sense desire or other, it's not that it's so bad, it's not that it's bad in itself, and no, there is no need to beat yourself up about it in the famous phrase. But what are you missing out on? And the answer is, we really don't know, because we don't know how radiant and positive and far up the spiral path our mind might be going at any time, if only we weren't fantasizing about lentils and halloumi. I mean, what a shame, in the bigger perspective. Okay. So that's one example. Okay, here's another few to do with other people, because a lot of the time, that's what these things are really about. So say, you've developed rather a liking for somebody on this retreat. Now, I know that won't have happened to anybody, so you'll just have to imagine this purely hypothetical example. Okay, you've become fond of somebody on the retreat. It gives a pleasant feeling either to see them or think about them. We like that. We want to perpetuate about it. Sorry, we want to perpetuate the feeling, craving. We seek to perpetuate the contact with that particular object of the senses. And again, we could be getting into more trouble now, because given the, like I said, it's not calling us ignorant, but like the spiritual ignorance at the beginning of the thing, which infuses the whole thing, we're now starting to invest something which is not going to be the object of our fantasies, with a sort of power to satisfy us, a sort of magical power to satisfy us, which it isn't going to have, however beautiful they are. So we're setting ourselves up for a fall there, and again, blocking out anything more characterized by love, contentment, or wisdom. And we have no idea how far that could go. Those are the opposites, of course, of the cock, the pig, and the snake, greed, hatred, and illusion. Just one example. On the other hand, say there's a difficult person in your life. Either thinking about them or seeing them, kind of in the same way, gives you an unpleasant feeling. That's actually conditioned by our actions so far, because you'll notice that the same person doesn't give someone else an unpleasant feeling. That could be interesting to reflect on. But up until feeling is conditioned by past actions, so we can't do anything about that anymore. Anyway, it gives us an unpleasant feeling. And it's this basic, really. There's contact, then feeling. It's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. In this case, we want to push it away. So what we might then need to crave, because we don't like the feeling that, say, I don't know, somebody else is more confident than us and we're shy. We don't like the feeling that that gives us. That could be contact, by the way. I mean, these things can loop back. It's not to be taken literally as a sequence. I should have said the 12 links. Things can, you almost have to draw it, but you can get this far around and then loop back to there, go up to there, loop back to there, or any other combination, really. So the idea that I'm shy and I don't like being shy, that could be the contact again. That could give me unpleasant feeling, and we're going round again. I want to get rid of that unpleasant feeling, so that means I need to get rid of that idea of myself. That means I need to either seek reassurance from somebody for the side of myself I want bolstered up, and I fear evidence to the contrary, represented by this person who's confident in a way that I'm not, and I find that difficult. I then need to protect that idea of myself, or say I think I just need to be kind of tougher. I need to invest in that idea. I crave it because it makes me feel better. Again, you're back to feeling. Do you see, I can go back. Probably all these things feed into feeling, actually. I need to perpetuate it. Say I do actually start behaving in a way that I think of as tough, okay, because it doesn't give me the unpleasant feeling of being shy around the tough guy or whatever it is. Say that starts to have effects on other people. I start swaggering around in a way that makes me feel kind of cool, kind of at ease. I learn a kind of way of talking and interacting that at least makes me feel good and kind of, I'm all right, Jack, I don't know about other people. I like to bond with other people who behave in the same way. Think about becoming there. So we had the lentils and halloumi thing, didn't we? We had the investing the object of our desires with qualities they won't deliver. But now start to think about the effects that we'll have on other people through identities that we are grasping, okay? Because we do actually become, we cultivate qualities in ourselves based on often a lack of wisdom. What we're trying to do as Buddhists, if you like, is cultivate them in a wise way, but we do the opposite too, okay? So that's, something about... habit. So these are all habits. I have a habit of fantasizing about that particular meal or thinking about cooking when I'm meditating. I have a habit of finding that sort of person attractive. It kind of reminds me of me and of my life. It reassures me that I'm sort of still me, even though this Buddhist retreat is making me feel a bit wobbly and different. I have a habit of feeling unconfident around this certain type of person. At least it's familiar, actually. I mean, we'd also grasp at a story that, I'm shy and I don't belong, because at least it controls the situation by explaining it. So trying to explain things to ourselves, which is always what's going on with that narrative that overlays primary experience, we're trying to appropriate it back into something that we understand, even if that's a painful view. So look out for that as well, views that you have of yourself that you yourself don't like, but they are at least secure. It's difficult to talk about how to, it's probably not the scope of this talk, sort of what to do about that exactly, because it's not like you need to go into a place that's really insecure. But we do need to at least taste the freedom of dropping some of the ideas about ourselves that at least we can see aren't helpful to us. Okay. So I thought I'd just give one more example of these five links in a more kind of cooked up version, because so far these have been relatively sort of raw, if you like, day-to-day examples of stimuli that might come into the senses simply on a retreat, which is well worth looking at because it's much more, it's much easier to be aware on a retreat. That's one of the reasons we do them. But say now you live in... Sweden, in a port town. Your father was a shipbuilder. That's what you apprenticed in as a young man. You've now lost your job because industry is draining away from that part of the country. Okay, that's quite worrying. You're the only income in the household. You know, not being able to pay bills in that part of the world is quite serious. This is on your mind. Okay, all that's giving unpleasant feeling already, of course. Say you're walking down the street and you see somebody from the colour of whose skin you can tell is from a different part of the world. They're unloading groceries into a shop that they run. Ordinarily, you wouldn't think anything of it, but because you lost your job last week, suddenly you think, huh, that guy's got a job. Okay, so that's contact. It reminds you of the feelings I've described above, which are unpleasant, which you want to get rid of. So another moment of contact that might arise is you now remember something you heard on a radio station in a cafe yesterday, the type of radio station where the producers might even be encouraged as they screen calls to let through at least one call in three from somebody who's actually quite agitated about the issue. And this person has said on the show, I think Sweden is for Swedes. Okay, you remember that. So that contact comes into your mind again, only because you were reminded of it, you know, in the first instance. That seems to be a way out of some of the uncomfortable feeling. Okay, that might start to condition your behaviour, because at least if you feel that other people agree with you, you know, in worldly matters, the group is more likely to succeed. It's different in spiritual life, in a way, the individual is more likely to, but that's another talk. You might start, I don't know, voting or talking about things or encouraging others to think or vote in certain ways that perpetuate that among the group in order to foster this kind of security that you're looking for, because it makes you feel better. I hope it's clear that I'm not trying to be sort of political here. It's more that the links which happen like that, you know, they're not a patient temporal sequence that waits for, you know, it's not like 5 minutes per link. These five links I'm talking about especially could happen like that. Even in quite elaborate situations, which you can always peel back, at least on some level, to feeling, which has been conditioned, like I say, you know, in a way in that story, up to the shipbuilder losing his job, is, if you like, the givens of that life. You know, there's lots more you could say, but say that person starts grasping onto a more nationalistic identity. Okay, that clearly starts to define an us and a them and a conflict and belonging and not belonging. And I don't know, I mean, you could go all sorts of places with this. Say this man sees the shopkeeper in a bar the next night, has had a few drinks, and curses at him. Okay? Now see the contact in that man's life. Okay? Somebody swears at him because of what he looks like, or because he's got a job, or something. Of course that feels unpleasant. Of course you don't want it. Of course you now need, you're now this man, you now need a way out of that. Or at least, let's say, we can understand how you might grasp at one. You might be looking around for one, and so you'd then be on the other side of the divide and so on. For as long as the reactive mind is in operation, okay? So these are some of the workings of that reactive mind. So now I had better give some better news and talk a bit about the point of freedom. Okay, so if you turn over in your sheet, or turn over in your mind. Okay, down at the bottom you can see contact, feeling, and this is the only thing you need the sheet for, so you can look back at me after this. Between feeling and craving is a sort of place off the wheel onto the spiral. Okay, that's all you need the sheet for. So what is that about? Like I've said, feeling is just going to arise. I may actually have conditioned myself to enjoy this sort of person, feel scared around that sort of person, as explained, but it's just going to arise in this life. What we can then do more about, or at least get more space into, is the time where we start to crave. Okay, and craving covers aversion and ignorance as well. We either want more of it, or you want to get away from it, or you don't pay the right sort of attention to it. Yeah. So we were being encouraged in meditation the other day to stay with feeling more. And that is one of the, I mean, I was going to call it Buddhism 101, but I mean, it's so much bigger than that as well. The ability to pay attention to and stay with the feelings that are arising, because our stories about ourselves and our lives will be arising from that point, and it's such a sort of well-fueled fire, it goes on and on. But that's where they're being stimulated from, okay? And that's the place where you can watch what you tell yourself about your experience and what you make your experience mean. So in some of these previous examples, I could make, seeing this person I'm not so fond of mean something negative about my personality, although maybe I'm not so fond of this other personality either, because it gives me this feeling. But that would be something I'm telling myself, and that would be what Vidyadharka called earlier, something more like a secondary reality. The primary reality is what you're feeling, The secondary reality is what you tell yourself on the basis of that. Okay, and that's part of the reason that the step onto the spiral starts there. Craving rips us away from primary reality like a riptide or like a fire. It's actually extremely hard in some circumstances. It's always possible to practice to not to crave. But that's the point where we have to work, because up until then is actually our primary experience. That's the information from the world, if you see what I mean. We then try to cook it up into something. Yeah? So if we can become aware here, part of what we'll see is that that craving or aversion, which if you remember, and this is where the image of the wheel is helpful, even though it's only an illustration, keeps it going round and round. Okay? If you go into craving, you just keep going round and round. If we can become more aware at that point, we'll know that craving or aversion is not going to ultimately satisfy us ever. Okay, we're going to keep going round and round. So we might become, well, hopefully, more and more deeply aware of the essentially unsatisfactory nature of mundane things. Okay, so that's the sandwich, the identity, the person, the idea that Sweden is for Swedes, whatever it is. Those are mundane experiences and views that are never going to satisfy us ultimately, so they'll never be the answer on their own. And if you can see that, if we can see that, we'll develop faith in something higher. Okay, and that is really the key. In the more positive vision of things, the whole wheel is suffering, and then the first link on the next sequence up is faith. It's very interesting, why would suffering lead to faith? But it's not so much that once you see the wheel is unsatisfactory, you know, naturally you just become a Buddhist and everything's all right again, and now you just get more and more joyful. It's that you've seen with a bit of wisdom the cycle. Okay, you've seen those habits, you've seen how we ourselves grip onto them, seen that ultimately it's unhelpful, keeps us in the reactive mind, blocks awareness and blocks freedom. And that seeing itself starts to produce faith, because we aspire, as we've heard in the human realm, you actually aspire or repine for something that we can align ourselves with more meaningfully to higher things than this wheel, okay? So this is the power of not reacting. I've just got one little story about this, again, to go back to the sort of more raw experience level. Just to illustrate the fact that staying with feeling, it's not easy, but there could be so much in it that we just don't know about, because most of the time we just don't manage it. So on my ordination course, which happens in a mountain spot in Spain, and you're doing a lot of meditation, you know, you get to the point where you think, another one? Yeah, okay. At a certain time of year, a lot of flies, and try as you might, you will never keep all of them out of the shrine room. Those little dangly chain door things don't work. And a fly flew onto me in meditation. I'd been working on my mind as directly or more directly than I ever had done for a couple of months straight at that point. A fly flew onto me, and it's quite unpleasant if you start to feel it crawling over your face. And I thought, I just couldn't bear the idea of going into a state as superficial as either swatting away a fly or wanting to. I just didn't want to go there, because I was fed up of living in that mode. Think about that in terms of most of day-to-day life. Part of the reason we, you know, find it so difficult even to experience our bodily physical self is just there's little bits of neutral or unpleasant or only slightly pleasant experience pinging around all the time. And we just kind of keep swatting away the fly in some way, yeah? And I just thought, I'm sick of it. I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. It actually started something quite powerful. I mean, it's dry there, and you know what they're going for is the moisture. I'm sorry to be gross about it, but the corners of your eyes, nostrils, ear cavity, lips. Okay, that's the bit they're really after, all right? And I decided I'm not going to do anything about this. And it was sort of, I don't know, almost sort of exquisitely unpleasant. You know, in the ear, you can hear the proboscis going up and down and in and out. Okay, all right, enough. All right. enough detail. It was quite a transformative experience not doing anything about it and letting it happen. I mean, it was intensely kind of unpleasant, but afterwards, and it went on for quite a long time. it's more of a test than you might imagine. Afterwards, I felt like a rock. I felt different. I felt really different. And I think it even sets up a little feedback loop that I cannot be at the mercy of little passing irritations. Even that, spiritually, is significant and can be quite powerful, and at least start to make you yourself feel like I don't have to be at the mercy of either swatting away the fly or just wishing I could, which kind of comes to the same thing in terms of mental states. Yes, perhaps just one more thing about stepping off the wheel. I don't know, because of previous conditioning and momentum and life setup that there isn't time to go into, I was quite invested in the idea of career before I came to the LBC, and was feeling unsatisfied by it, okay? To cut long story short. I paid attention to the feeling, decided to trust the feeling, that I kind of just don't like this. Trusting your instinct could be as simple as that, because you could draw up pros and cons on a bit of paper, talk to yourself about it endlessly, talk to other people, and actually not get anywhere if you never quite trust the feeling that I don't like this. So I decided to step out of that and just said yes to working at the LBC. This is just one example. And, joining the team at the LBC and working on the LBC, I mean, it's affected my friendships, how I feel about my life, my capacity to be generous, even ordinary skills, my wish to connect with people, my concern with status. Partly I'm listing these things to say you don't know where a positive step's going to take you. So I decided to listen to the instinct, pay attention to the fact that something was not actually feeling good. That's not maybe not the whole, you could misunderstand that, but paid attention to the feeling, did something about it, didn't even know where it would lead. Very important. And the not knowing is important as well. So I think we might have had a reference to this earlier, but John Keats, the poet, had this idea of negative capability. And that's basically the ability to do nothing and not know where it's going. So I think he was talking about it in the context of poetic inspiration. As an artist or as someone creating something, you need to be able, a bit like Garavati was inviting us to do tomorrow, you need to be able to do nothing and be all right with that. Not worry what it means and not grip onto something that we do know and that is familiar again, because something about the familiar structure of ourself will loosen as we do nothing. Try it. So that negative capability is important. But of course, it's not just poetic inspiration. We're trying to develop the creative mind. And I think just the same could be said. So in the gap between feeling and craving, there's an opportunity for negative capability, and at least not doing the predictable thing, at least not staying in the habit that restricts us. Okay. Then we might eventually, as I hope I've shown, renounce some of the identities that reinforce a solid separate self, and keep us, ourselves, closed and small, and keep the ordinary mundane world, i.e. the wheel, turning for ourselves and others. So we could actually go forth from or transcend some of those identities that we have grasped onto because they have seemed to offer us a way out of experience we don't want and a way into experience that we do want. Otherwise, this thing will just keep spinning. It will do that by itself. We don't even have to take any action. The wheel will go round and round, unless we're creative. So yes, it's not easy, as in the fly story, which I thought was just... But the potential and where it might lead could take us ever higher, as on the spiral. We don't know where the spiral's going, really. You can say enlightenment. We don't really know what it means. Even small, seemingly small, positive steps, we don't know what consequences they'll have. So I thought this is very well illustrated in a short poem by Pat Kavanagh, which I'll read now. To be a poet and yet not know the trade. To be a lover and spurned by all women. Twin ironies by which great saints are made. The agonising pincer jaws of heaven. Okay, so forgetting the gender you know what I'm trying to say, of that. Probably it's for the rhythm of the line. To be a poet and yet not know the trade. So to be inspired but unfamiliar with how to wheel and deal. To be a lover and spurned by all women, full of love but not get what you think you want or not get the immediate feedback. Twin ironies by which great saints are made, the agonising pincer jaws of heaven, which I think is one way at least of talking about that point where we might step off the wheel. Okay, so I don't think we've done homework on previous retreats, but since other speakers have given homework, I thought I would suggest, and you can take this to your groups tomorrow. What unhelpful identities do we think we could go forth from, and by that I mean transcend? So what identities have we grasped onto that are not helpful that we might transcend?
You've been listening to the London Buddha Centre. Make sure to press the subscribe button, and then please take a moment to rate and review this podcast. It really helps other people to find us. Thank you.